All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Monday, September 21st, 2020. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other radio programs I've participated in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all the details. All right, with that said, let me introduce our special guest this evening. My good friend Monica Schaefer is joining us once again. Monica, welcome back to the program. How are you this evening?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, John.
Good. Yeah, it's always good to catch up with you. It's been about a year since you were on, actually. You were last on last year on September 14th, shortly after the anniversary of 9/11. And of course, today is September 21st, 10 days after 9/11. So I'm curious, just to get started, do you think that 9/11 is still relevant or important in your view? I know it's kind of, obviously it's been a huge wake-up call in my life, and I know you and your brother, it was sort of the same way. It was one of the key events that led you down this path. So I'm just curious, you know, we're just a couple weeks past the anniversary. Is 9/11 still relevant or important in your mind?
For sure it is. For sure it is. You see, I mean, a lot of people know that it isn't as they presented it to us. It also, I just want to say, it's sort of like people saying, well, Monica, why do you still talk about the Holocaust? That's so long ago. That's not relevant anymore. We have other problems that are pressing us. Well, these things are extremely relevant because the structure of the world is based on these lies. I mean, the world is structured on these lies, you see. So when we bring down these lies, then all the lies topple. So definitely 9/11 is still relevant. And I also find that that's an easier one to bring up with people who are not yet awakened to the fact that we're being lied to. You can bring up 9/11 and point out some really obvious things. And you can tell right away that either they'll brush you off because they kind of know that the official story doesn't really make sense, but maybe they don't really want to go down there, but down that road. But or they'll say, yeah, that you're right. That doesn't make sense. But all the rest, you know, like it's an easy one. It's almost at the kindergarten level of pointing out the errors in the official story, where it's a little bit different with the Holocaust because it's so ingrained in people for so long. But yeah, it's definitely still relevant. Definitely.
Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, our modern foreign policy is based around the official conspiracy theory explaining 9/11. And I agree with you. In my mind, I mean, in my experience, I should say, talking about 9/11 with just, you know, your average person, it seems like it's a much less emotionally triggering topic than revisionism and, you know, the Holocaust narrative and stuff like that. And I think a lot of it revolves around like the propaganda associated with the fake Holocaust story, all these Hollywood movies of these poor Jews suffering and dying and being murdered and all this other nonsense. And not only that, but also, you know, we see all these quote-unquote Holocaust survivors that like tour the country and, you know, go and speak in front of schools and you know, school children and other public events at public libraries and stuff like that. So, and their stories are very traumatizing and emotionally triggering. So I think 9/11 is a little bit easier to get into with people. And again, you know, in my experience, most people, they may not know all the details, but they don't believe the official narrative, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I find most people just don't really have the energy or the passion or the bravery, the courage to really delve into it and figure out what the heck happened, you know?
Yes. You know, that's interesting what you say. it makes me realize, okay, why is it not so emotionally triggering? I think I know the reason why, because people who have gone sort of partway down this road of looking at what's going on in the world, the 9/11 story, they don't necessarily need to address the JQ, the Jewish question, with that one. They'll say, oh yeah, inside job, blah, blah, blah. But then, of course, if you go down that road further, you will see that it's intricately linked with Israel. And so then it will, of course, again, be emotionally triggering, you could say. But with the Holocaust, oh yeah, it's just all about the Jews and the persecuted Jews. That's their narrative. That's their story. That's their identity. It's pretty much their religion. And so that one is harder for the general public to look at, address, because it's just been so indoctrinated and pumped into our very bloodstream since the day we're born, pretty much, you see. So
yes,
yeah,
definitely. No doubt about that. I mean, they're still making Hollywood movies about the Holocaust. They're still writing books and memoirs about the Holocaust. They're still speaking about it. Again, as you said, it's like a key. It's not only a key, it's like the central aspect of Jewish identity. Like if you look at public opinion polls conducted by, you know, organizations like the Pew Research Center, you know, when they're surveying Jews, like what, how do you identify, what makes you identify as a Jew? Is it like going to synagogue? Is it, you know, what is it? And like the vast majority of them identify with the Holocaust, the fake Holocaust story, and the more general idea of Jewish persecution and Jewish victimhood over centuries. It's deeply ingrained in their culture, and you can tell there's this very deep-seated hostility towards the West, towards the white, formerly Christian West, and the Holocaust is really the epitome of it. And as we know, a lot of this is based on totally fake or distorted historical narratives.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. I also want to just go back to this word that you used, revisionism. A lot of people might not know what that refers to. And I myself have always had a little bit of a problem with that word, because the first time I heard the word revisionist or revisionism, first of all, I'll just tell the listener what that does mean, in case you don't know it. We're talking about people who are looking at the Holocaust, what happened, and that, you know, saying, look, this didn't happen as they are telling it to us, and that's called revisionism. Now, my problem with that word comes from my gut instinct first reaction to that word, and it still holds, is that, wait a minute, we're not the ones revising history. They changed the facts and we're bringing it back to what really happened. So the truth, somehow that word doesn't sit right with me. And yet the great, you know, people who did the primary research and all the work, the hard work, like Robert Faurisson, he comes to mind as just really one of the greatest, who did so much for exposing the lies and telling the truth and doing the primary research to show what really did or did not happen in World War II in these supposed gas chambers, which did not exist other than to disinfect clothing. But anyway, they themselves call themselves revisionists because they're revising the history books, we should say, back to truth-telling instead of telling lies. I just have such a hard time with that word because it sounds like we're the ones revising what actually happened, but that's not the case. You
right.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, the way I understand it, it's basically kind of like reinterpreting like an official historical orthodox narrative. It's you know, challenging the mainstream orthodox established narrative of any.
That's
and it's not necessarily strictly pertaining to the Holocaust. I mean, you could engage in historical revisionism on any number of topics.
That's right.
But it's mostly, you know, of course, it's very much associated with the historical revisionists who took a second look at the official Holocaust narrative and totally debunked it. That's the thing to me. Is, you know, you look at, you mentioned some of the individuals involved in this, and there's many others. The Barnes Review is a great source that, you know, we we've published and sell like and pretty much every central important revisionist book that's been written about World War II and the Holocaust especially. But in my mind, I mean, if you take an objective look at this and look at both sides of the debate, look at the orthodox, traditional, established view of World War II, and then look at what the revisionists are saying, the facts and evidence that they're presenting, there's just absolutely no doubt in my mind that the revisionists have entirely debunked the official orthodox narrative, exposing it as just a total fraud, as basically fake history.
Absolutely.
Almost nothing stands up to scrutiny with the official World War II narrative, but especially, you know, as it relates to the Holocaust. So, and that's a point that I've been making for years. You know, we've talked about this many times on podcasts, but, you know, it's worth emphasizing and underscoring, you know, because it is so important in my mind.
Absolutely. And I mean, the great, in my mind, they have proven us right by doing such crazy things as making evidence illegal in the court. You know, when you're on trial for saying the wrong things, in other words, you know, just for speech, to these things are illegal in many countries to say that, gee, there were no gas chambers. There, you know, 6 million Jews did not get killed in gas chambers or in these death camps or whatever. They were work camps. And, you know, for basically bringing out the facts. And then, you know, you go to court and you cannot present evidence which explains how you reached your conclusions. That's illegal. And that, to me, if we were full of lies, they could just say, yeah, you're lying and here's the evidence, here's the facts. It would be easy, right? But they can't, because they do not have any evidence for their side of the story. They just tell us that it's the most documented and the event in the history of humanity, and they just keep repeating that ad nauseum, but they can't present us with the evidence. So they make evidence illegal, because the evidence will prove them wrong and us correct. And so how do they deal with that? They just make it illegal and give you more jail time if you try. And that's what they've done to my brother Alfred.
yeah, and I want to talk about Alfred's plight in just a second. One point I wanted to make, if you look at like a lot of the evidence, quote unquote, that the, you know, the mainstream establishment historians cite, is like these alleged eyewitnesses, which, I mean, if you go and you know, revisionists have done this, have gone through and dissected some of the alleged eyewitnesses to the Holocaust and you know, what they've alleged over the years, going back to, you know, shortly after the war. And I mean, some of this stuff is just so outlandish and outrageous that it's laughable that anyone would even take it seriously. So, you know, you have like these ridiculous fairy tales that these people have told over the years. That's a huge part of the evidence that they cite and that they use to justify this official story. And then, you know, they basically just refuse to allow anybody to objectively investigate any of the forensics at any of these camps. So, I mean, it's just a totally distorted and fake historical narrative that has just been totally institutionalized by the entire Western world, and I mean really much of the world at this point, and you're just not allowed to question it, you know?
Yes.
That's basically what it boils down to.
It is the only thing they have, is their eyewitnesses, and we're not allowed to say anything against the eyewitness reports or their stories, because that would be, what do they call it? Insulting the memory of the dead? No, they use a different word.
Desecrating yes. The memories of the dead, yeah. I know.
Yeah, so we're not allowed to do that. And a perfect example of how we're not allowed to do that is that court case that took place, I believe, in California a number of years back, when the Institute for Historical Review put out an offer of a reward, I think $50,000 offer, a reward offer for anybody who would prove the Holocaust, you know, just with actual hard physical evidence. And instead, they got sued. Mermelstein, I think, was the...
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, Mel Mermelstein, I think, was the guy's name. And it was, Willis Carter was involved with it. Yep.
And instead of this award, you know, they couldn't collect the award because they didn't present evidence. So instead, they sued the Institute for... he lost sleep, and it was a desecrating the memory of the dead, like you said. And he was awarded something like $17 million for, hurt feelings and lost sleep and this kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's so Jewish. Everything revolves around their feelings. You know, it's like so typical, like of this is exactly the Jewish strategy.
And bringing it back to this, that's the only thing they have is eyewitness, quote unquote, evidence. And the Ernst Zundel trials, the great Holocaust trials in the 1980s that took place in Toronto, those are absolutely historic court cases, 1985 and 1988. And I would encourage people to read about those, because that's one of the very rare times that evidence actually made it into the court about the Holocaust or the non-Holocaust. And all those eyewitnesses that appeared in 1985, their testimony was destroyed and shredded on the stand when they were cross-examined, every one of them. And so they never appeared again. Eyewitnesses never appeared again, as far as I know, in a court. So in 1988, they certainly did not appear at that second great Holocaust trial in Toronto that was being held against Ernst Zundel. And yeah, there were just no eyewitnesses anymore because, well, they made up all kinds of excuses why they wouldn't go on the stand anymore. But basically the reason was because their testimony was shredded.
Yeah.
You know, things like, I saw smoke. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say Douglas Christie was the attorney representing Zundel, if I'm not mistaken. And you can see, in fact, Zundel, they made some documentaries about it. I remember seeing years ago. It's been a while since I've watched any of it, but it's very powerful, very good stuff. If I would encourage anybody to check it out. You probably can't even find it on YouTube anymore.
But oh,
maybe
you
on like BitChute. Oh, can you? Maybe you can. I don't know. It's been a while since I've looked into it.
Are you talking about Off Your Knees, Germany? And
yeah,
that was a 90-minute documentary. I found it just the other day. I think these things, they don't go away. They get re-uploaded on other channels. They might not be on YouTube anymore, but I think you can find that still.
Right, yeah. You could find it on like BitChute, I'm sure, and some of these other like alternative YouTube type channels. But yeah, it's incredible. I mean, Douglas Christie was cross-examining these people and just totally, you know, just exposing them for the total liars and frauds that they truly are.
Yeah, Ernst Zundel, he put together a wonderful team of people to help him. And Robert Folisson was, I would say, the primary advisor to the team and to Doug Christie for, you know, the questions and whatnot. And he came with fantastic credentials. He did such good primary research in many aspects of the so-called Holocaust. I mean, you know, architectural evidence, physical evidence, chemical evidence, all these things that he had dug up with primary research. And there are others, many others who did fantastic research. Germar Rudolph comes to mind. And, you know, Fred Leuchter, who was then sent over for these trials and went over to Auschwitz as a believer of the Holocaust. And, you know, he said, well, whatever I find, I will report on. And yes, he was an honest man. And then by the time he was done with his forensic study of the actual physical locale where these gas chambers were supposed to have been, he came to the conclusion that not a single person was gassed to death. Not a single one. You see, so after he had done very thorough forensic research and it was all very well documented, that was the conclusion. So anyway, all these things came out in those Zundel trials in the 1980s in Toronto. So how did they go after Ernst Zundel? Well, they do it in different means, you see, because he basically won that debate, you could say, won the argument. But they, you know, they go after him in other ways. They firebombed his house, the Jews did, and eventually
the Jewish Defense League was basically trying to kill him, assassinate him at the time. Yeah.
Yes. And then years later, and it would be post 9/11 when there are new laws about, you know, how to handle quote unquote terrorists or or terrorist threats and whatnot. I mean, he was living in Tennessee and the United States at the time when the three governments colluded. That's Germany, Canada, and the American government colluded to how are we going to get this guy? Because we can't get him on evidence and his argument because, you know, he wins hands down. So they did some trickery. You know, he missed some appointment that it didn't tell him about, is something about a passport expiring and this and that, whatever. They went to his home and kidnapped him, basically sent him to Canada, where he spent 2 years in solitary confinement, and after which he was extradited to Germany. And there he went on trial and spent 5 years in jail there for this Holocaust denial thing, which is paragraph 130 in Germany. Yeah.
Yeah, what an outrage. And your brother Alfred is dealing with sort of a similar circumstance over in Germany. He has been in prison now for over 2 years, is that correct?
Yes, it is. And he's supposed to spend 4 years in prison, according to, you know, the what he was sentenced to. So he's just a little bit over halfway through that. And, you know, I just alluded to it briefly a few minutes ago about how you are not allowed to bring evidence into the court, evidence that would basically be on your side, you know, to explain how you reach your conclusions, evidence that prove that this is a lie. You're not allowed because supposedly you're saying these things in public again because it's a public trial. And you're not allowed to say these things. So there's no logic, no rhyme or reason to it. And this is, of all places, if you can't defend yourself in a court, I mean, really, it shouldn't be called a court. It should be called an inquisition, or Alfred called it the Muppet Show, you know?
Right. Well, it's just a total in-your-face tyranny.
It is
what it is. I mean, you know what? And can you give us just a brief overview of Alfred's persecution in Germany over the course of the past couple of years?
Okay, so 2018 was our trial. So I was imprisoned January 3rd, 2018. Then 6 months later, our trial began, and they put both Alfred and I in this trial together. After the first week of the trial, they went to his home and basically kidnapped him out of his home and arrested him and put him in jail, and he hasn't been out of jail since. Now, when they put him in jail, the trial was not finished yet, so he should not have been put in jail. He lives in Germany. He was attending court. It was very clear that he was eager to attend the court. He wasn't running. He wasn't running from the country, but they said, oh, because it's such a serious crime, and so the motivation would be high for him to flee, and we're going to pick him up just to make sure he doesn't flee.
Now, Monica, real quick, I hate to interrupt you, but you guys were both basically, you know, in trouble with the German authorities for publicly expressing your views about World War II and other topics, but especially World War II and the Holocaust on the internet, right? I mean, that's what this all revolves around, is your YouTube videos, interviews you've done. Okay, I just wanted to make that clear.
It started, I'll just briefly say, it started this round, I guess you could say, started with my little video called Sorry, Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust. 6 minute video. That was in 2016. And my cousins reported us to the authorities that put us on the file. They did a house raid on Alfred 2 months later, stole a bunch of equipment, computers and whatnot. And it kind of went from there. But I had no knowledge that I was under investigation or in a file, that I was, you know, I'm a Canadian. I flew back home to Canada after we put that video on the internet. And yeah, by the way, I was visiting my brother when I produced that, or he produced it, but I did the video. I was visiting my brother who lives in Germany. I live in Canada. So I came back home and carried on and went. Then Alfred was, you know, being harassed, and yes, he had charges against him, but nobody ever made any indication to me that I had any sort of legal challenges against me. I had other challenges in my life because of the video, don't get me wrong, but that was completely different. That was this thing called ritual defamation in my little hometown of Jasper at the time, but no legal challenges like that. Alfred, that's a different story, but he lived in Germany, right? Anyway, I went to visit him for Christmas 2017, and then early 2018, that's when I was arrested. At Sylvia Stolz's trial, by the way, we've talked about that before, but in case, you know, some listeners aren't aware of that, but that's a whole nother part of the story too, is Sylvia Stolz. And she's now still in jail, by the way. I think she'll be released quite soon after this latest round of being in jail for 18 months for a speech she gave in Switzerland in 2012, describing the situation, the legal situation in Germany, and describing what had happened to her as a lawyer at Ernst Sandl's trial, after which he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. So all of this is very interconnected and intertwined, this whole story. So, you know, that brings us back to Ernst Sandl's story. Anyway, so I was then kept in the jail because I was a quote unquote flight risk. They didn't want to let me go because I, you know, they were afraid I'd go back to Canada and then I'm out of their clutches. Okay. So anyway, our trial went for 4 months from July to October in 2018. And at the end of that trial, I was released on time served and I had been there 10 months. So I had a 10 month sentence. Then they released me. And, but Alfred was then given something like, what was it, 38 months. But the following year, 2019, he was on trial again. This is the critical part, for things that he said and did in court. He did his little straight arm gesture indicating how high his dog Pavlov can jump. And he, like, he is quite fearless. And just the fact that body gesture can be so triggering for the Germans, I mean, that tells you something. You know, there's symbols and gestures that are very, very frightening to the powers that be, the powers that should not be. So, you know, putting your right arm straight out at and saying, this is how high my dog Pavlov can jump. And he literally did say those words, by the way, but you know, that some people call it the Roman salute, but it's very, very forbidden in Germany to do that. And he did that in court on day one of the trial. So that already, you know, didn't go over well with the court. But primarily it's when he spoke, you know, presenting evidence that was in our favor, evidence of what actually happened and didn't happen. And the judge stopped him numerous times and said, I have to warn you, if you go down that road any further, you know, that is new crime. We'll have to lay new charges. But Alfred would basically brush off the words, the warning of the judge, and say, well, you know, you want to lock me up for 6 million years anyway, and I'm just telling the truth, and I will carry on telling the truth. So he had no fear, and he still has no fear, and he writes letters that indicate that he is still absolutely just bursting with the spirit and the fight for our lives, the fight for our freedom, the fight against this tyranny, the fight for right and truth and all that is good in this world. That is what he is fighting for, and he is not let being in prison and being in actually horrendous conditions, or he has not let that get him down.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And your website's freespeechmonica.wordpress.com. And I will of course have a link to that when I post this program, but you post a lot of his letters on your site. And of course you can find how, you know, if you wanted to write him a letter, you got his address, you know, his mail address and everything. So I would encourage people, if they're interested, to send Alfred a letter of support. But you published a recent letter that he wrote to a man named Frederick. And it was very powerful. I actually just read it before we started the recording. And yeah, it's very good. Do you want to talk about this letter to Frederick? It sounds like it's somebody that you have corresponded with as well over the years.
Yes. Well, actually, Frederick wrote to me in jail as well, and he wrote the very moving stories. And Alfred was also, he obviously wrote similar things to Alfred. He wrote about his uncle's experience. So Frederick had an uncle who was a soldier, an American soldier, and was there in Germany during the war and after the war. And these experiences changed him for life. When he was back home, he did not honor the American flag anymore. He didn't want anything to do with any of the veterans, associations or anything, because he was absolutely, oh, disgusted. That's an understatement with what he saw and what they had done to the Germans. And so he told Frederick these stories, and when Frederick was in his early 20s, he really sat him down and said, "I think you're mature enough now to that I'm really going to tell you some of these things." And so that's what Frederick had written to me, and then he obviously wrote these things to Alfred as well. And then this was Alfred's letter back, and I have a copy of the letter. Frederick sent me this, and so I published that. And then I published segments of the letter that Frederick had written to me while I was in jail, because I know that those were the stories. I just didn't have the original letter that he wrote to Alfred, but I think that the one he wrote to me was similar. So, yeah, his uncle's experiences in the war there, the Allies, all lies, they did horrible things to the Germans, and this is not something that we see in the Hollywood films. It's always the bad, bad Germans. But what did they do to the Germans? I am telling you, I mean, it's horrible. They were firebombed for one thing. That was the true Holocaust, actually, is that all the cities over a certain population in Germany were firebombed. So that's not a military target. We're talking about firebombing cities where there's women and children and old people and hospitals, so injured people. I mean, the one that I think most people do know about is Dresden, but even there, the official story is that, oh, 25,000 people died. No, it's in the order of probably close to 500,000. And the intention was to roast, baste 600,000. That's what Churchill said. Don't tell me how to hit a military target in Dresden, tell me how I can baste 600,000 Germans, this kind of thing. Anyway, so all these places got firebombed, but what Frederick's uncle had talked to him about, I mean, one of the stories, and this was in that letter, was about how the American soldiers, they would, they'd be walking past some burnt carcasses, burnt, woman clutching her baby to her chest, and children beside her, they're all burnt, and these American soldiers spit at them or shot them up with guns and laughed. And it's just so, they were so dehumanized, and for so long they had been given all this propaganda that they didn't see these German victims of their atrocities as being human anymore. I mean, that's the
Yeah.
only way you can explain it.
Well, and that's where you see the devil at work in all of this. I mean, the more I reflect on, this period of our history, it's like this is straight from the mind of Satan. And
It is.
even the official narrative of World War II is straight from the mind of Satan. It's a total inversion of what actually happened. And I mean, this is something that would probably shock, your average normie, but it wasn't the Jews who were genocided during World War II, it was the Germans. It's literally the exact opposite of what they say, and there's a million different ways to prove this. I think Thomas Goodrich's book Hellstorm does a marvelous job at proving that exactly, at least documenting and proving that the Allies were the ones that were actually engaged in a systematic, planned, premeditated, this is what they were intending to do. They wanted to exterminate the German nation and subjugate the German people, and that's exactly what they did. And as you said, they were firebombing them. I mean, you know, we could go on and on. You know, we've talked about this in the past, and I'm sure most people listening are aware of these facts, but it's very well documented. That's the thing. It's like we have all the facts and evidence on our side to demonstrate what actually happened, which is the total inversion of the official narrative. Meanwhile, the Jews, who control the media, control the history books, control the government, control their educational establishment, they have all this fake, you know, these fake manufactured, you know, totally concocted narratives, and we're just expected to, you know, accept it blindly, and it's just totally unacceptable, it's totally evil, and again, straight from the mind of Satan, and I think Alfred has recognized that for a long time, and it's becoming increasingly more and more obvious.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that Alfred writes in the early part of the letter, he says, when he read Frederick's letter with these stories, and that's not the only story, you go to the website and read this. It's very, I would highly recommend reading this. But anyway, Alfred just says, you know, I mean, the letter made him cry, but it also made him be very, very glad that he did what he did to put himself right where he is writing that letter. See, that's the thing. We are in a war. Like, the war never ended in 1945. We are in a war. Most people don't see it, don't recognize it. But when we see it and recognize it, and then, you know, we get these stories told to us. And so Alfred's in that prison cell in really horrible conditions. That's sort of another aspect, another story here. But he then gets these stories from people sharing these, and it just reinforces his will to fight this, like, whatever it takes. I mean, some people might say, well, what good is it to be in prison? Well, the thing is, he's in prison not of his own choosing, but it's because he has done what he's done, is just telling the truth, trying to spread the truth. I mean, that's why they put him in prison, is because he was very effective and is still very effective. I mean, these letters get out, and he's, you know, we share these stories, and this proves how bad they are. I mean, this proves that we are right. I mean, some people might say, well, that's not forensic hard evidence. Well, no, but you know what I mean, John. Like, they have nothing other than force to try to shut down the truth, right? That's the only thing they have left. I mean, it's total tyranny. And, you know, the harder they are doing it, the more obvious it is that we are in a war. And it's not a war of our choosing. We didn't choose this war. But when we find ourselves in it and we understand the stakes, what's at stake, how high the stakes are, yes, we want to do everything in our power to try to stop this. And, you know, we could probably bring it full circle to the present, because there's so much going on right now that it just makes it so obvious that this war, like, they're ramping it up. I mean, I think our enemy is very desperate. They're very afraid of us, by the way. I think that's why they're ramping things up so quickly right now with this whole corona stuff, which is, you know, just rolling out the police state, the communist police state, what they're doing here, just controlling the people and whatnot. But when we see what's at stake, you know, they want to destroy us. They want to absolutely destroy us. And yeah, we had better win this war. And so Alfred is he's in the position right now where, you know, we have nothing to lose anymore. We better pull out all the stops and do whatever we can to stop this, you see.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. Yeah, I completely agree. And Alfred's always been that way. I mean, ever since I first encountered him, he's been a guest on the Realist Report. It's been years ago, you know, but well before all this happened. Yeah. But yeah, it's incredible. And I mean, you look at, you know, you look at the official World War II narrative, you look at 9/11, you look at what's happening now, like, with this idea that, you know, oh, it's America's like this white supremacist country, and there's systemic racism, and, you know, blacks are being persecuted and, you know, murdered by police officers every day across the country. It's literally the exact opposite. I mean, everything is like the exact opposite. And it's so, like, mind blowing and infuriating at just how obvious it all is. I mean, that to me is what's incredible, is it doesn't take too much to see through this. And once you do see through it, you see it everywhere, obviously. And, you know, it's easy for me to say that. You know, I've been sort of, you know, thinking like this and realizing this for, you know, well over a decade at this point. But, I mean,
yes.
You know, you see just the total blatant double standards, the total, like, media bias and media fakery even. I mean, my God, with what's going on with all these, like, Black Lives Matter, it's really like a color revolution, essentially, is what's happening in this country. But
it,
I mean,
really
everything's like totally on its head. You know, you'll hear the media like justify, oh yeah, you know, the Black Lives Matter, they can go fight systemic racism and that's no problem. But heaven forbid anybody come out and protest the tyrannical face masks and other coronavirus lockdown measures. That's going to spread the virus even more. I mean, it's just so stupid anymore. It's like, how can anybody not see through this? A lot of people are seeing through it, which is good, but.
The
parallels with World War II, it's the same thing. It's just the total inversion of reality from the same satanic people that control the media and control their government then and they, you know, as they do today.
If you could see me, I'm nodding my head with everything you're saying. It's absolutely an inversion. Everything is inverted. Everything. And to those of us who have opened our eyes, it's really, really obvious. But, you know, a lot of people are now starting to get it. They're starting to question everything because they're thinking, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense with their lockdown measures and whatnot. But you see, the mainstream media, they spin it always to their favor. So, for example, where I live, nobody's getting sick around here. Nobody's died, even if you believe that there is a, you know, some virus called COVID-19, which they don't test for COVID-19, but you've had some good guests on that have explained all that. I'm not going to go into that too much. But even if you believed their numbers of people dying of this boogeyman disease, it's really, really low. So if you point that out to folks, they'll say, oh, see how successful we've been with our lockdown. So that's great. So whatever way they spin it to their favor. But
yeah,
I want to tell you, I want to tell you a couple of recent observations or a recent experience I had. I had to bring somebody to the hospital in Edmonton in an emergency. So this is quite a drive. It was, you know, a 6-hour drive away, but I had to do this and we find ourselves in the emergency room. Now, let me tell you, going to the emergency room in a hospital now during this crazy COVID-19 time, it's like scenes from some weird, like, it's too weird for even a movie. Okay, so my friend who was, he told me afterwards about some of the things after I dropped him off. I couldn't even sit with him in the waiting room because during COVID, you know, it's all kinds of weird rules now. Okay, so I had to go out.
So you probably couldn't even go inside the hospital, right?
Well, I could then after he was in a room and then I was escorted to where he was. But I couldn't go into the waiting room with him. That's a whole nother scene. I mean, I had to stay out at the entranceway for a while until I could figure out what was going on and this and that. But, oh, and they, you know, they push the mask on you and this. Oh, it's just crazy. Anyway, he's telling me the next day some of the things he observed there. So this guy gets brought in by the police and he's in handcuffs and he's really protesting this. He's in his early 20s and he's, you know, giving him a piece of his mind, like, get me out of here. What are you doing? And they would haul him out of his home. This is probably around midnight and he's in handcuffs, but they're telling him, you're not under arrest. Well, what do you call this? I'm in handcuffs. Like, and he was forcibly taken from his home. And they keep saying, oh, you're not under arrest. It's, I guess, some kind of a, you know, legal situation there that they're in limbo land. He's not under arrest, but he's in handcuffs, forcibly brought to the hospital because he was, quote unquote, suicidal. Now, this man was not suicidal, but a disgruntled woman had reported him. It called the cops on him, said he was suicidal because, get this, because he refused to wear a mask. So that made him suicidal. And they
actually
Yes.
Unbelievable. And how often is this happening across the country? This is in Canada. This is happening all over, I bet, though.
Yeah, that's okay. So that's Canada. Now, while this was going on and the cops were there with this man who was not being kept peaceably, he was really loud and they kept saying, "Oh, keep your voice down." And actually, my friend says, "No, you tell him," you know, like he was really with this guy. Anyway, then this young white woman comes in and the back of her head is bleeding, split open, and she had been beat up, and so she's waiting and getting, I guess, some initial care there. But then there's this black guy, and he was her aggressor. He's the guy that did this to her, and he's kind of making all kinds of threatening moves to her, and she's cowering. And the cops are right there, and they turn a blind eye. They do not respond to this situation. And this black guy leaves again, so it's not like he beat her up in the hospital, but he is the guy who did this to her. That's why she was in the hospital. Now, can you imagine if it was reversed? It was a white guy and a young black or whatever other race woman. Doesn't matter. It would be, I mean, all hell would break loose. And by the way, the so-called suicidal young man was also a white guy. Like these are scenes that, you just shake your head and you think, can this be real? But it is. I mean, then on the bigger picture, it
This
was.
is like scary. I mean, this
Yeah.
is insane, yeah.
But
But
see,
it's
black people,
typical. I mean, it's this is the Western, the modern Western world, thanks to Jews and thanks to our inability to deal with the Jewish question, the Jewish problem, whatever you want to say.
the black people are actually being encouraged to do violence against whites, beat up a whitey, that's good, do anything. And the white people have no recourse because, I mean, we've heard so many stories about at protests or at incidences where the person who calls in, calls the police and say they were just broken into or they were just assaulted or whatever, they end up getting arrested. Like the person who is the victim gets arrested. I mean, we've heard that over and over again. So it's kind of open season right now on whitey, and yet they're saying, oh, white supremacism and white privilege and white this and white that. I mean, everything is reversed. You can't even overstate that. Like it's just so reversed. But anyway, what do we do? I mean, we have to, first of all, we have to say no, not just say no, but just don't obey these mask rules. And I can tell you from personal experience that you can just go and without a mask, even if they've told you have to wear a mask, and this and that city or town has mandated the mask, you have to wear them to get on into this place or onto that place. You don't. And from my personal experience, that is the truth. I've just gone around here, there, and everywhere without a mask. And if I've been confronted with them, I have just simply refused. But most of the time, I don't get confronted. You might get some looks, even if all the other people are wearing masks. So
Now,
now.
you know what? Let me say, because I've talked about this a few times, on different podcasts, and I had some interesting experiences this past weekend. And generally speaking, I do not walk. Like, well, see, the thing is if I'm walking around in public or like outside or whatever in my car, or, like something like that, of course I'm not going to wear a mask. If I go into a business, I don't walk in wearing a mask. And a lot of times, especially lately, nobody will say anything to me. But the thing is it j this happened. This is the past 3 or 4 times I've been into a business. This is what happens: is I'll walk in, or whoever I'm with will walk in. We don't have a mask on. Someone will eventually come up to us and say, "Hey, do you have a mask? We need you to wear it when you're in the store." At that point, I'll either, if I don't have one, because there's been times where like I literally don't even have one on me, and I'm like, okay, well, I don't have one. If you have one, I guess I'll wear it. And so they give me one and I wear it. That's actually lately what's been happening, is they're and they're friendly about it. Like, they're not like trying to be rude or anything, but, and I'm not trying to be rude and cause a big scene, But I want it to be known, look, no, I think this is a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you're forcing me to wear it in order to, you know, buy what I got to buy, then I guess I will. But I'm never rude about it. And they're usually never rude about it either.
I don't think they can force you. I mean, I suppose people will come back to me and say, well, yeah, look at they're doing all these violent arrests and stuff. Like Australia, it's really, really bad right now. But the thing is, that's not the case here yet now. But if we let it happen, it will get that bad. And so that's why I say I would encourage the listeners just refuse to wear the mask. Because
the thing is that they ask you to leave. At least in my experience, and then they're like, okay, well then you have to leave. And you know, it's like, okay, well I'm not going to risk getting arrested or something, or you know, cause a big scene. So it's like, you know, I don't want to be rude about it. I know these people working there are in a difficult position. Like, they probably don't like wearing the stupid thing either, but you know, they kind of have to, I guess. That's the thing is, like, if I were a business owner and like they were forcing me to do this, I'd just say no. I mean, there's no log. That's the thing. That's what it takes. It's going to take some real gutsy, courageous leadership to put an end to this. And sadly, I don't see that right now.
Well, I think that we have to put an end to it. We have to just, I don't know. I mean, maybe then we just have to leave. If it's a store, then don't give them your money.
That's pretty much what I've been doing. Yeah.
What I've been told too here, though, for example, in a neighboring town, and I have a friend who lives there. She told me that their grocery store, today was the first day that their staff all have to wear masks. And the rumor went around that all the customers would have to. And she said, oh, well, I'm not going to shop there anymore. But then somebody told her, no, don't worry. You don't have to wear the mask. We will ask. So that person was very, excuse me, John. That person was very honest and clear with her that she says, no, don't worry. We have to ask you to wear a mask, but we cannot force you to wear a mask. She was told that in private. So, yeah, so people have the impression that you have to. You don't. They cannot force you to. That's how it is here anyway. I don't know. And maybe different jurisdictions is going to be different. But what the main thing is this. What I have experienced, and I went back to my old hometown in Jasper where they do have this mask bylaw that everybody's supposed to wear a mask downtown, whether you're indoors, outdoors, just in the whole downtown. So you walk around there and you see most people wearing masks, even outdoors and indoors, pretty much everybody. I marched into various places and I wasn't accosted. One place I was, you know, given or asked about a mask at the door, and there was somebody screening the door, and I just said, no, thanks. I'm exempt. It's bad for my health. And the guy looked startled, and then he let me in. And all the other places, I just went in. And thing is, all the other people were masked. And some of the people, well, one guy, he asked me, how did you do that? He was all excited, right? He wanted to rip off his mask too. But most people, it will just not occur to them that they can say no, that they can just not abide by these rules. So I'm going to just, as long as I can, do this, just lead by example and tell people about it. They cannot actually force you. Maybe in some places they do, like, okay, they're going to say, look, in Australia, they're really arresting people and having violent takedowns of people over masks. Okay, but they're not going to stop. And if we let them go that far, they'll do that here too. So I guess I'm just trying to emphasize we have to stop this somehow. We have to do it on mass.
I totally agree. I mean, the line in the sand is drawn. And yes. Alfred seems to recognize this. Like, for example, in this letter that we're talking about with Fred from – or that he wrote to Frederick, I should say.
Yeah.
That really – this is like a really big – should be a big wake-up call. I mean, how many wake-up calls do we need at this point? But this coronavirus thing is really impacting everybody very, very deeply and personally, and in a lot of cases economically and professionally. I mean, how many people have lost their job, or how many people have had to either shut down their business or like totally revamp their business practices? I mean, I couldn't even imagine being a business owner right now. And what kills me is if I were a business owner, I would hire a lawyer and challenge this legally. I mean, what are the and there are some lawsuits actually that I've read about
Yes.
recently. I know in Pennsylvania, I think it was Pennsylvania, there's a lawsuit challenging all the governor's order. I think this is the same in Ohio. Don't quote me on that.
Yes.
I don't know all the details off the top of my head, but I have read about some lawsuits. There's a Christian church, a big Christian church here in Los Angeles that has totally defied the county and the state's, coronavirus mandates, and they're still holding services and,
Good.
yeah. So, I mean, there are people,
That's
there are a few examples,
actually,
but
there's more
most,
and more, John, more
yeah.
and more. I'm reading them, and I wish I could remember the details of the things that you can counter. When you're told to wear a mask, you have to wear a mask. You can counter that, and you can just tell them that, first of all, just say, no, it's bad for my health, or I'm exempt, or whatever. I don't even think you have to go get that exemption card. I know a lot of people do that. They go get the exemption card, and that's fine. That's great. You could do that. But you don't have to. Just tell them you do, for medical reasons, you cannot wear a mask. And then if they say, oh, yeah, really? Like, then you say, it's none of your business. Why? It's, medical confidentiality. And you could tell them, look, I can sue you. This is a public place, like any store and whatnot. Those are public places. This is a public place, and nobody can force you to do something that's bad for your health
Right.
in a public place.
I generally agree with you. I think it's kind of tricky though, because for example, one store there's like basically one store that I shop at that's very organic, like local stuff basically. I won't say the name of it, but it's a store I've been shopping at for years. So I'll go to this store like maybe once a week, and then I buy pretty much everything else from a farmer's market. When I go to the farmer's market, I'm not wearing a mask. Like nobody's saying anything to me about it. Although most of the people around me are wearing masks, but this one store, I was like really trying to figure out like what their mask policy was, because there's a couple different locations, and one location in particular that I would go to, they had the sign up, you have to wear a mask, but I was going in there for like weeks and nobody said anything to me. I didn't wear a mask, no one said anything. Just this past weekend, I went in there, and the manager actually came up and was very nice about it, was very like almost apologetic, like ashamed and like embarrassed, and was like, "Hey, I'm sorry, but in order to be in here." And I did read on their website, they have a corporate policy saying that it is absolutely required for anybody in their stores to wear a mask. If you can't wear a mask, or you refuse to wear a mask, you have to shop online or whatever. There's other options they have, but they make it very, very clear, and it seems like they're very, kind of strict about it now, that in order to be so. And I mean, in that case, it's a private business. I'm not gonna make a big deal about it. Give me a mask, I'll put it on for a minute. I think it's retarded, and I'll say that.
Here's an idea.
But
A
yeah.
friend of mine, she did this. She went into one of these shops where they said it was absolutely mandatory, you have to have one. And so, okay, she didn't kick up a fuss either. She took the mask from the greeter at the door and hung it on her ear and did all her shopping with this mask hanging from one ear.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
And nobody said a word. So,
Yeah.
it's just a charade, and most of the people, the staff know that it's a charade, but okay, they did their job. You've got the mask. I mean, you could, wear it on your head or wear it across your behind or something. Okay, I'm wearing a mask, whatever. I don't know. I just, to me, the mask is really, really, really important thing to resist, to fight, to do it whichever way we can. Maybe you have a mask that's got a big hole cut out in the mouth and nose area, and okay, I'm still wearing a mask. That's fine. And if they complain about it, say, look, my mask is just as effective as yours, because
Yeah.
really, I mean, maybe there's other creative ways to deal with this, but I cannot overemphasize how important this is to resist against this masking at just as whatever way we can. We that they.
I completely agree with you. I completely agree with you. And it's going to take some creativity, it's going to take some courage, it's going to take a little bit of flexibility, I guess. It's just, I don't know. I wouldn't recommend anybody going out there and confronting people or like getting in a big argument about it or making a big scene or anything like that. That's totally just not a very wise thing to do in my mind. I mean, if they're basically saying, look, you got to wear a mask or you can't be in here, just tell them, okay, thanks, I'm not going to shop here anymore then. Don't make a big scene about it, or don't get in a fight, or not necessarily a fight, but don't cause a big dramatic scene or something like that. That's not going to help anybody. But yeah, no, I mean, I hear you. It's really this whole thing is just, it's so stupid. I mean, it's like unbelievably stupid. And this whole concept of like the sheeple, I always hated that meme, like, the dumb sheeple that just go along with everything. But then I'm like driving down the street, and mind you, I'm in Southern California. It's like 75 and sunny, like every day practically. It's beautiful weather, absolutely beautiful weather. And these idiots, every single one of them, are walking down the street on the beach with a mask on. And I'm like, what are these people doing? It's so incredible. Not all of them, but I mean, I don't know. It just depends on where you're at, really. But a lot of people, I mean, really, it's crazy. It's like a lot of people just put this thing over their face and walk around in public as if like it's a new fashion statement or something. It's so incredible to me. It's like this, it's so
They've got their
uncomfortable. It's hot out. I mean, it's warm. This is, you can't breathe with it on. I mean, what are you doing?
They're selling these nice outfits now to, all the back to school outfits. Now they got the matching mask with the matching whatever. Yeah, you're right. It's
It's
absolutely
so de
ridiculous.
it's so degrading. It's like really degrading.
Yuri Betsmanov comes to mind, when people have been demoralized and it's been going on for so long, then you shower them with facts. He says that famous line, you can shower them with facts, it won't make a difference until the boot is across the neck. But you see, the boot is coming across the neck as we speak, because conditions are going to worsen if we don't stop this. And you see, small businesses are being closed. People are going to be suffering. And largely, some of this is brought on by ourselves, because we, the generic we, because we're going along with these things. Like, they have just found out how easily movable the whole population is, in terms of everybody just obeyed. Put on the mask, yeah, everybody puts on the mask. Roll up your sleeve for the vaccine, oh, everybody's lining up. Well, maybe not. Wait a minute, maybe not. I mean, they are now, I think, in panic mode, because they're finding out that a lot of people are saying, no way, Jose, I'm not going for that vaccine. And so they're, I mean, they are in panic mode, and they try to make it look to like, oh yeah, everybody's on board. And I guess when we look around, we see all the people wearing their masks. But see, that's why I want to say this, that a lot of those people wearing masks, they don't like it and they don't believe that there is this virus threat, but they're doing it just because they think they have to. That's my experience here anyway, that a
Oh,
lot of these people,
that's exactly what it is. They're going
they
along.
think
They're
they
not
have.
thinking for themselves. They're just doing it because, yeah.
And so I don't know, somehow we have to change the mindset in people that say, look, you don't have to. And if en masse we stop this, stop wearing them, then what are they going to do? For example, I talked to a little girl who was grade 9, and she was telling me that, yeah, they sit behind their desk all day, sit at their desk all day, like, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 hours a day or whatever, with their mask on. And I think it must be hell. And I
Oh,
said
it's
to her,
torture. It's
you should,
psychological torture.
yeah, you should all of you just take off those masks and just stop wearing the mask. Now, if something happens to you, what are they going to do? Throw you in jail? No, they're not going to throw you in jail. You're all in grade 9, and just talk to your friends. Do it all en masse. Take off those masks and refuse to put them back on. And if they send you home, then go home. Stay home. Don't go back to school. Like, that's a bad environment these days anyway. I say every opportunity, don't send your kids to school these days. But okay, so this girl's in school and they're all wearing masks, and I think it's torture and it's dehumanizing. And what are they learning with that? It's just terrible. So they should just all refuse to wear that mask. And then if the teacher basically is, forcing them to wear it, they go home, and then they say to the teacher, well, enjoy your unemployment. Like, that's how it should be. I mean, I know that's probably easier said than done for me as an adult, and these kids, I don't know. I mean, but maybe I'm
Well,
prejudiced.
Yeah. No, it's good. It's good to have conversations like that. I try to do the same thing in every opportunity that I have. And really, at the end of the day, and we're going to wrap up here in just a minute. We're already a little bit over the hour mark. But there's one excerpt I really want to read from Alfred's letter that he wrote to Frederick, and then we'll kind of wrap up. But really, I think what it's going to take leadership, because most people, and this is like one of the biggest, I guess it took me the longest to realize this. Like the older I get, like most people are just there. They're just like robots. They just go along with. They don't think. They need someone to tell them what to do. They need someone to tell them how things are gonna go. Like there's we need real, actual leaders that are honest and truthful and have some sort of virtue and have some sort of sense of what is going on, and who recognize, the things that we recognize and realize the issues that we realize. And that leads me to this little excerpt here. Alfred wrote to Frederick. He said here, in German, there's a little saying that goes like this: if you are a bird and you don't fly when the cat comes, then you belong to the cat. To that I add, if you are a human being and you don't think when the Jew comes, then you belong to the Jew. And that's so true. And the Jew is gonna obviously take advantage of and exploit anybody who's not thinking. And most people have not been able to think because of all the false and fake history the Jews have been feeding us for so long, and all the other psychological warfare that's been going on in the background. But what it boils down to is leadership and somebody telling people what to think and challenging the Jews in a big time way. And that's exactly what we need and what we are lacking right now. And that's what Hitler was all about. Hitler understood this and was explaining this to people in a big time way, and built a whole movement, not necessarily based around that, but based around the truth in general, and explaining the truth about the Jewish problem and explaining who these people were and what they were up to. And that's exactly what we need right now in a big time way.
Yes, we do. Yeah, that's good. Just before we do leave, John, I would be remiss if I did not tell you about the Truth and Justice for Germans Society. So we have a website called truthandjusticeforgermans.com, and it really is all in the name. I don't have to explain too much because I know we want to wrap up the show, but I just wanted to make sure you knew about that and that the listeners know about that. Please do visit that website, truthandjusticeforgermans.com. That's all one word
Yes.
there. And, because that brings us kind of full circle around to what we started this conversation with and how everything was upside down. Everything in our history books is upside down, and it's still upside down now. And so we're trying to write it up again.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, no, I will actually post a link to the site when I post this podcast so people can check it out. And yeah, I know. Are you the official president? Is that right?
Yes,
Yes,
I
very
am.
good. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's good. Okay, good. Well, Monica, thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's always good to catch up with you.
Very, very nice to talk with you, John. That's been great. And I really enjoy listening to some of your other podcasts that you have with guests. I don't listen nearly often enough, but whenever I do, I really think they are great. So thanks for all the good work that you do, and all the best to you, my friend. And
Well,
yeah, it's been great.
thanks, Monica. I appreciate it. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Okay,
Bye-bye.
bye.